The Murder of Nancy by Bill Sykes in Dickens' Oliver Twist is probably one of the most brutal scenes in English literature.
I killed the girl, they said. So they said. I killed the girl, they said. So they said. I hit her on the head with a bloody great lump of lead. And I left her there for dead. Damn her eyes!
Charles Dickens commits murder by Raymond Fitzsimons, with Joss Ackland as Dickens.
They put me into court. Into court. They put me into court. Into court. They put me into court. And they tied me to a log. And they left me there. By God, damn their eyes!
The year is 1869. Charles Dickens has returned to the quiet of his house at Gad's Hill for the weekend. A sick man, he's working his way through a farewell reading tour of Britain, which, following his strenuous American trip, has done so much to wear him down. His face is lined with pain, and he drags one foot. It's the longest tour he's ever attempted. And yet, this is the very time when he's chosen to add to his repertoire the murder reading from Oliver Twist, The Murder of Nancy by Bill Sykes. It's evening. The curtains of his study are drawn as he sits alone, rehearsing this most violent and demanding of all his readings.
Without one pause or moment's consideration, without once turning his head to the right or left, without once raising his eyes to the sky or lowering them to the ground, but looking straight before him with savage resolution, he muttered not a word, nor relaxed a muscle until he reached his own house door. He opened it softly with a key, strode lightly up the stairs, and entering his own room, double-locked the door and drew back the curtain of the bed. The girl was lying half-dressed upon the bed. He had roused her from her sleep, for she raised herself with a hurried and startled look. There was a candle burning, but he drew it from the candlestick and hurled it under the grate. Seeing the first light of day without, the girl rose to undraw the curtain. The housebreaker regarded her for a few seconds with dilated nostrils and heaving breast. Then, grasping her by the throat, dragged her into the middle of the room and placed his heavy hand over her mouth. Then he freed one arm and grasped his pistol. The certainty of immediate detection if he fired flashed across his mind, and he beat it twice upon the upturned face that almost touched his own. No! No, no, it's not nearly violent enough. And he beat it twice upon the upturned face that almost touched his own. I never thought when I made this reading that I'd still be working on it. I go over it again and again at least three or four times a day, and I still can't get it right. I know I'm arousing passion and horror in the audience, but it should be more than that. On the other hand, the full effect could be too horrible. At first, I couldn't make up my mind whether to do it at all. None of my friends like the murder. I don't know what's the matter with them. I'm on my farewell tour. I'll never read again. So isn't it natural? I want to leave behind me something very dramatic and passionate, something for people to remember me by. But everyone's against the idea. As for Chapels, the firm organizing the tour, they don't give a damn one way or the other. The murder makes no difference on the receipts. The public knows it's their last chance to hear me, and tickets can be sold two or three times over. Last week for David Copperfield, we turned away hundreds. How people love the courtship of David and Dora. They just can't have enough of Dora. She had the most delightful little voice, the gayest laugh, the pleasantest and most fascinating little ways that ever led a lost youth into hopeless slavery. There really was a Dora in my life. Her name was Mariah. Mariah Beadnell. I can see now that loving her was a hopeless business. The more I went at it, the more I exposed myself to ridicule. Thank God I can say I always acted fairly. Under kindness and encouragement one day and total change of conduct the next, I was always the same. I never held out promises which I never meant. I never roused hopes which I had no intention of fulfilling. Oh, Mariah, I've said it before and I say it again. I have borne more from you than any man ever bore from any woman. If you had ever felt for me 100th part of my feeling for you, there would be little cause for regret. I never have loved and never can love any human creature breathing but yourself. But as things turned out, I married Catherine Hogarth. Right from the start, I began as I intended to go on. My dear Catherine, if ever you have a desire to be capricious, if ever you have a desire to tease, then you must overcome it. It will not make me more fond of you or either of us more happy. If you really love me, then you must show me that your love for me, like mine for you, is above the ordinary trickery and frivolous absurdity which debases the name and renders it ludicrous. She staggered and fell. But raising herself on her knees, she drew from her bosom a white handkerchief, and holding it up towards heaven, breathed one prayer for mercy to her Maker. It was a ghastly figure to look upon. The murderer, staggering backward to the wall and shutting out the sight with his hand, seized a heavy club and struck her down. George Dolby doesn't like me doing the murder. He's my road manager, dear old Dolby. He's a rough customer, but on the road he looks after me as tenderly as a woman. He always takes an adjoining bedroom so that he can come in and talk to me through the night. But I just cannot sleep. The pain in my foot keeps recurring and wearing me down. And I've still got 24 readings to do. I should never have insisted on giving 100. I know the country can stand it, but I'm beginning to wonder whether I can. Thank God I can get back here for the odd weekend. So peaceful at Gadshill, if it wasn't for the memories and the bad dreams. Mary Hogarth died. Catherine's sister. She had lived with us since our wedding day. She died a year later. She was only 16 when she came to us. And from the day of our marriage, she was the grace and the light of our home. When she died, I lost the dearest friend I ever had. Thank God she died in my arms, and the very last words she whispered were to me. When I die, I want to be buried next to her. I cannot bear the thought of being excluded from her dust. I've never had her ring off my finger since the day of her death. After she died, I dreamed of her every night for months, sometimes as a spirit, sometimes as a living creature. I never lay down at night without a hope of her coming back, and she always did. She followed me everywhere, no matter where I went. I left London for Yorkshire, and after all those miles, when I lay down to rest in the snowbound inn at Greta Bridge, she came to me. I'd gone to Yorkshire to investigate the notorious boarding schools that flourished on unwanted children. I found out for myself all about the rascalities of those schoolmasters. Let any boy speak without leave, and I'll take the skin off that boy's back. Mr. Wackford Squeers of Dotheboys Hall. The way such characters opened out was to me one of the most surprising processes of my mind. Given what I knew about them, what I didn't know sprang up. I was as absolutely certain of this being true as I was of the law of gravity. I felt my power more than I'd ever felt it. I had a greater confidence in myself than I'd ever had. I knew without doubt that I could sustain my place in the minds of thinking men, though 50 writers started up against me. But not now. Not now.
I goes up Auburn Hill in a cart. I goes up Auburn Hill in a cart. I goes up Auburn Hill. At St. Giles I takes me jill, and at Tyburn makes me will. Damn my eyes!
I miss the quietness of this place when I'm on the road, and I'm perpetually counting the weeks to be read through and perpetually longing for the end of them. Yet I sometimes wonder whether I shall miss something when they are over. The old days. The old days. I wonder if I'll ever get the frame of mind back as it used to be. Something of it, perhaps. But never quite as it used to be. You should have known me then. I was the life and soul of every drawing room. I was Boz, the inimitable Boz. Dick, the intrepid Dick, dashing into every situation, giving my opinion on every subject under the sun. I was jocular, pathetic, illustrative, and wise, always wise. I spoke to crowded meetings all over the country. I spoke out against the abuses of this so-called democracy, the schools, the prisons, the workhouses. And all the time, I was married to Catherine. And she became more of a donkey with every passing year, an awkward, slow-moving donkey, falling in and out of every coach, making herself black and blue with bruises, dropping her bracelets in her soup, and in size, enormous. Every year, a coming event cast its shadow before her. She was more or less constantly pregnant. What a life! I was surrounded by nurses, apothecaries, mothers-in-law, and babies. No wonder I went out most of the time. I loved to walk and walk and walk in the green lanes, mile after mile after mile with Forster, Stanfield or MacLeese, preferably all three. Or to ride out to Richmond through the park and over Barnes Common, stopping for a red-hot chop at some village inn. Or muffled up on the winter's day for a good brisk walk over Hampstead Heath. MacLeese, Stanfield, Forster, fellow countrymen. You have called me forth, and I will come. Oh, blessed star of morning, such a trip we had into Cornwall. Sometimes we travelled all night, sometimes all day. Heavens, if you could have seen the necks of all those bottles peering out of the carriage pockets, if you could have witnessed the deep devotion of the postboys, the wild attachment of the ostlers, the manic glee of the waiters. I never laughed in my life as I did on that journey. It would have done you good to hear me. I do believe there never was such a trip. Then back to Catherine. Yet our home became wonderfully changed when Georgina came to live with us. She was 16 years old, the same age as her sister Mary when she first came to us. I traced a strong resemblance between Mary and Georgina. It was so strange that when we were sitting together, I seemed to think that what had happened was a melancholy dream from which I was just awakening. For so much of her spirit shone out in this sister that the old times came back again at some seasons, and I could hardly separate it from the present. Especially at Christmas, when all our celebrations were a continuation of that first Christmas of my marriage. My first Christmas with Mary. And did we know how to keep Christmas? I'll say we did. Such dinings, such dancings, such blind man's buffings, such theatre-goings, such kissings out of old years and kissings in of new ones never took place in these parts before. And I, as the unparalleled necromancer, Ria Rama Ruse, conjured up for my guests, aided by Stanfield, who always did his part exactly the wrong way, to the unspeakable delight of all beholders. Oh, my dear eyes, if you could have seen me conjuring the company's watches into impossible tea caddies and causing pieces of money to fly and burning pocket handkerchiefs without hurting them, you would never forget it. I'll say we knew how to keep Christmas. I wrote a little book about Christmas. It had quite a success. Yet, would you believe it? Some people objected to Scrooge giving Bob Cratchit a turkey as a present. They said it was grossly inconsistent with political economy. Political economists, factory owners, workhouse masters with their facts and figures. All they can deal in are facts and figures. I wrote another Christmas book in sunny Italy, of all places. I was sitting down, trying to think of a good subject, when all at once the quietness of my study was shattered by the sound of bells. It was maddening. All Genoa lay beneath me, and up from it came the clang and crash of all its steeples, pouring into my ears in a tuneless, grating, discordant, jerking, hideous vibration, which made my ideas spin round and round and round. Facts and figures, put 'em down, shoeless children, put 'em down, all sick workers, put 'em down, wandering mothers, put 'em down, born bad, facts and figures. Facts and figures. We have heard the chimes at midnight, Master Shallow. The chimes. It's a great thing to have my title and see the way I can work the bells. Let them clash upon me now, from all the churches and convents in Genoa. I see nothing but the old London belfry I've set them in. In my mind's eye, Horatio, I like the idea more and more. A book that will strike a great blow for the poor. Something powerful, but tender and cheerful. And if my design be anything at all, it will have a grip upon the very thought of the time. Oh, I could do it then. But not now. Not now.
So it's up the steps I go. Very slow. Very slow. So it's up the steps I go. Very slow. So it's up the steps I go, and you bastards down below, all standing in a row. Damn your eyes!
A letter came out of the blue. A letter from Maria Beadnell. After all those years, she might have been dead for anything I knew. I recognized the handwriting on the envelope. 25 years vanished like a dream, and I opened it with a touch of my young friend David Copperfield when he was in love. She told me she was married with 2 little girls. I could hardly believe it until it occurred to me that I had 10 children of my own. I wrote to tell her I had never been so good a man as I was when she made me wretchedly happy. I told her I should never be half so good a man anymore. She wrote again, saying she had really loved me in the old days, and that we had been separated by cruel misunderstandings. Dearest Maria, you ask me to treasure what you tell me in my heart of hearts. Oh, see what I have treasured there through all this time and all these changes. Please, let us meet soon. I never have loved and never can love any human creature breathing but yourself. We met. But when I saw her, all my passion died. Maria, who had been so slender, had grown very stout and short of breath. That was bad enough. Maria, who had always seemed so enchanting in all she said and did, was now long-winded and silly. That was even worse. Maria, who had been spoiled and flirtatious as a young girl, was determined to be spoiled and flirtatious now. That was the fatal blow. She tried desperately to put herself and me in our old places. Now, when the stage was dusty, the scenery faded, the youthful actors dead, and all the lights extinguished. I was sorrowful to think of the way I'd come to that night. That I should have missed so much, and was now growing old, and would soon be dead. And what had I found? from the misery of my childhood down to that night with Mariah. What had I found? Always the same question. Always the same unhappy feeling, undefined, like a strain of sorrowful music faintly heard in the night. Always something wanting, something missing. The sense of the one happiness I'd missed in life. The one friend and companion I had never made. It would have been better if Catherine could have helped me and shared the many thoughts in which I had no partner. Always to be alone, never satisfied. Catherine and I were not made for each other. There was no help for it. We were a strangely ill-assorted pair for the bond between us. Nothing on earth could make her understand me. What happened was bound to happen. I'd seen it coming for years. You must bear in mind the unsettled, wayward feelings which are part of the price one pays for holding on to the imaginative life. I only kept this down by riding over it like a dragoon. But for how much longer? The skeleton in my domestic cupboard was becoming a pretty big one. It was a ghastly figure to look upon. The murderer staggering backward to the wall and shutting out the sight with his hand, seized a heavy club and struck her down. The bright sun burst upon the city in clear and radiant glory. Through costly colored glass and paper-mended window, through cathedral dome and rotten crevice, it shed its equal ray. It lighted up the room where the murdered woman lay. It did. He tried to shut it out, but it would stream in. If the sight had been a ghastly one in the dull morning, what was it now in all that brilliant light? He had not moved. He had been afraid to stir. There had been a moan and motion of the hand, and with terror added to rage, he had struck and struck again. I gave the first public reading of the murder. The audience sat frozen in their seats. They didn't come to life until after I'd left the platform. Their cheers were so loud I could hear them in the quiet of my dressing room. But I was too exhausted to return and acknowledge them. Then the room filled with people, all congratulating me and telling me I should have been an actor. I told them that if I hadn't become an author, I'd have certainly been an actor. In fact, it was a very close thing. When I was 20 years old, I was offered an audition, but on the day I was laid up with a bad cold, I told the manager I would try again the following season. But by that time, I'd made a great reputation as a newspaper reporter and left off thinking of becoming an actor. A professional one, that is. My company of amateurs raised hundreds of pounds for charity. At the depth of my misery with Catherine, I was involved in a play, a melodrama, The Frozen Deep, inspired by Sir John Franklin's Arctic expedition. And who do you think played the leading part? Why, Dick, of course. The unconquerable Dick. Let the rehearsals go forward. I was everywhere, directing the play on stage, erecting the scenery behind. No detail escaped the eagle eye of Dick. Strip off your coat, roll up your sleeves, stuff the pockets of your waistcoat with nails and tacks, grab a hammer and start work. This is the life. Hard work, the true elixir of life. Hard work that stretches the muscles and sets the blood glowing. I memorize my lines on long walks at night, shouting out to the terror of passers-by. And the play? Shall I tell you about the last act? Richard Warder, that's the hero, that's me, saves the life of his rival at the cost of his own, carrying him to safety over snow and ice to the feet of the girl they both love. All the cast were amateurs, except the ladies, of course. They were professionals. The Ternan sisters, Mariah and Ellen. As Richard Wardour, I die with my head on Mariah's lap. I died so movingly that even though she was a professional actress, she could not control her emotions. The tears fell from her eyes like rain and flowed over my upturned face. I whispered to her, my dear child. It will be over in 2 minutes. Pray, compose yourself. But she couldn't restrain her tears. What a performance I gave. I electrified the audience. Oh, blessed star of morning. I do believe there never was such a play. I was very struck by Maria's younger sister, Ellen, or Nellie, as we call her. A most attractive, sweet little thing. 18 years old, slightly built, fair hair, blue eyes. How I wished I had been born in the days of monsters and dragon-guarded castles. How I wished a monster with 7 heads had taken the princess, whom I adored, to his stronghold on top of a high mountain and tied her up by the hair. Nothing would have suited me half so well as climbing after her, sword in hand, and either winning her or be killed. What a frame of mind for a middle-aged man. Then the play was over. I felt hemmed in on all sides. I knew I must break out or I would die. My blankness was inconceivable, indescribable. My misery amazing. I wasn't getting on any better with Catherine. Worse, much worse. Neither were the children. Neither could she get on with herself or be anything but unhappy. She'd become excruciatingly jealous. She claimed to have obtained positive proof of my being on the most intimate terms with at least 15,000 women of various conditions of life. Please respect me for this vast experience. Catherine has neither loved nor been loved by the children, never presented herself before them in the role of a mother. No one could understand this but Georgina, who had seen it grow from year to year. Her sister Mary understood it as well. It was Catherine's misery to live in some fatal atmosphere which killed everyone to whom she should be dearest. It was my misery that no one could ever understand the truth in its full force, or know what a blighted and wasted life my marriage had been. I instructed my servant to transform my dressing room into my bedroom. The doorway between the dressing room and Catherine's bedroom was closed by a wooden door and the recess filled with shelves.
Only Angmoney comes to. He comes to. Only Angmoney comes to. He comes to. Only Angman, he comes to, with all his bloody crew. And he tells them what to do. Damn their eyes! Damn their eyes! Damn their eyes! Damn their eyes!
I must be having a nightmare. What old women call the horrors have been creeping over me from head to foot. I have been afraid of myself. I am tired. So very tired. Friends tell me to rest. They told me to rest in that autumn of all others. Rest, they said. I was weary of rest. I had no satisfaction but in fatigue. Too late to say, put the curb on and don't rush at Hills. The wrong man to say that to. I had no relief but in action. I knew that I would rust, break, and die if I spared myself. Much better to die, doing. Ride on, rough shod if need be, smooth shod if that'll do, but ride on. Ride on over all obstacles and win the race. I had been assured that if I were to give a series of public readings of my works, the receipts would be enormous. I knew I must do something, or I would wear my heart away. I could see nothing better to do that was half so hopeful in itself or half so suited to my restless state. Dismiss from your mind any reference to my domestic circumstances. Nothing could put them right. It was all despairingly over. A dismal failure had to be borne, and that was the end of it. So though nothing could alter or soften it, I had the notion that the mere physical effort and change of the readings would be good for me as a means of bearing it. My heart was jagged and rent and out of shape. I had no sooner begun to read publicly than Catherine accused me of taking Nellie Ternan for my mistress. A girl young enough to be my daughter, of an age with my 2 daughters. I would not allow Catherine or anyone else on this earth to cast a slur on Nellie's purity, no more than I would allow anyone to cast a slur on my daughters. Mamie and Kate, believing their father to have a mistress the same age as themselves, I would not have it. I would not have it. Catherine should not have doubted me in this matter. She should have shown her confidence in me and Nellie. But what did she do? She went running to her mother and her sister Helen. God knows what stories she told them, but back she came, demanding a separation. So be it. After 22 years of married life and 10 children, so be it. Of course, Georgina took my side. Her family put every pressure on her, but she stood by me. When Catherine left the house, Georgina remained in her rightful place with me and the children. But the Hogarths were spreading rumors about me. They were responsible for the story going round London that Nellie was my mistress. Monstrous, villainous, my good name was being destroyed just as I was showing myself on the public platform. I demanded that Mrs. Hogarth and her wicked daughter retract their evil accusations. They must retract formally and in writing. I would not pay a penny for Catherine's maintenance unless they retracted. I was adamant. They signed. Oh, yes. After holding out for a fortnight, they signed. But this did not stop the rumors. It seemed that nothing could stop the rumors. All London was whispering about me. The whole country was whispering. Not only coupling my name with Nellie, but saying I was in love with Georgina and had turned Catherine out. How could I go before an audience and whisper against me? I had to speak out. So I issued a personal statement denying these terrible lies. It was published in Household Words on the front page in bold type. I most solemnly declare that all these whispered rumors are abominably false, and whosoever repeats one of them after this denial will lie as willfully and foully as it is possible for any false witness to lie before heaven and earth. And something else. Something else was needed. A letter, not to be printed publicly, but to be shown discreetly to particular individuals. Mrs. Dickens and I have lived unhappily together for many years. On many occasions, nothing has stood between us and separation, but Mrs. Dickens' sister, Georgina Hogarth. From the age of 15, she has devoted herself to our home and our children. In the manly consideration which I owe to Mrs. Dickens, I will merely remark of her that some peculiarity of character has thrown all the children on someone else. For some years now, Mrs. Dickens has frequently said to me that it would be better for everyone if she were to go away and live apart. There is a mental disorder under which she sometimes labors. I have always replied that we must bear our misfortune for the sake of the children and remain together at least in appearance. But recently it has been suggested that even for the sake of the children, it would be better for me and my wife to separate. Two wicked persons have coupled with this separation the name of a young lady for whom I have a great attachment and regard. I will not repeat her name. I honor it too much. Upon my soul, there is not on this earth a more virtuous or spotless creature than this young lady. I know her to be innocent and pure, and as good as my own dear daughters. He had not moved. He had been afraid to stir. There had been a moan and a motion of the hand, and with terror added to rage, he had struck and struck again. Once he threw a rug over it. But it was worse to fancy the eyes and imagine them moving towards him than to see them glaring upward as if watching the reflection of the pool of gore that quivered and danced in the sunlight on the ceiling. He had plucked it off again. And there was the body. Mere flesh and blood no more. But so much flesh. And so much blood. And so, in that autumn of all others, I came face to face with many multitudes and realized for the first time the full extent of my fame. But I little knew when I started this venture that I'd still be doing it 10 years later. Yet it's best for me to wear and toss my storm away in this restless manner. Of course it's tiring. With a different place each night and a different audience, it's a terrible strain. I miss Nelly when I'm away, but I dare not take her with me, not when I'm so much in the public eye. The fatigue is telling severely upon me. I cannot sleep. My head is dazed and worn by the gas lights on the platform and the incessant railway travel. That is the worst of all. 4 years ago, I was travelling from Folkestone to London on an express train when it crashed into a bridge. Some of the coaches were smashed to pieces. No imagination could conceive the ruin of those coaches. The tremendous weights under which people were crushed, the complications into which their bodies were twisted up among the iron and the wood. The screams were terrifying. I've never been able to throw off the effects of that accident. The screams of the dying. I can still hear them. The mangled corpses. I can still see them. I have a dread of trains, of speed, of any sort of journey. Even a ride in a hansom cab fills me with terror. Yet here I am, committed to constant railway travel. After that accident, some sort of lameness broke out in my left foot. It's baffled the doctors. Of course, I'm not so foolish as to suppose that all my work can have been achieved without some penalty, but tonics always bring me round. Except that I cannot sleep, and I have such a severe pain in my head that it's hard for me to do anything, especially after 100 miles shaking on the train. The danger light, the dismal mouth of the tunnel, the high wet stone walls of the cutting. Now, there's no doubt that horrible accident tells more and more instead of less and less. Whenever I'm on a train, I have this sensation that the carriage is down on one side, generally the left. What is the danger? Where is the danger? There is danger overhanging somewhere on the line. Some dreadful calamity will happen. It is not to be doubted after what has gone before. Surely, this is a cruel haunting of me. I am determined to bring the murder to a state of absolute perfection. I have told Dolby it must be set apart from all our other effects and judged by no other reading standard. Last week in Edinburgh, I committed the best murder yet. I tore myself to pieces. You should have seen the audience. I don't think a hand moved or an eye looked away, and there was a fixed expression of horror all over the theatre. But Dolby, that man's caution will be his ruin one of these days. After the performance back at the hotel, I was choosing readings for the various towns to be visited, and he said he must point out that the murder was taking precedence over all the others, that it was down to be given 3 or 4 times a week. He argued that as the success of the tour was assured, it made not a halfpenny of difference to the receipts which readings were given. The public was so keen to hear me read for the last time, they would come in the same numbers for an old favourite as they would for the murder. Copperfield, Nickleby, Pickwick. These would produce all the money we could take. And I would be spared the agony of tearing myself to pieces 3 or 4 times a week. I lost my temper and raved at him. Damn you, Dolby, damn you. I shall commit the murder whenever I wish. I am so immersed in it that I have a vague sensation of being wanted by the police as I walk about the streets. The girl was lying half-dressed upon the bed. He had roused her from her sleep, for she raised herself with a hurried and startled look. There was a candle burning, but he drew it from the candlestick and hurled it under the grate. Seeing the first light of day without, the girl rose to undraw the curtain. The housebreaker regarded her for a few seconds with dilated nostrils and heaving breast. Then, grasping her by the throat, dragged her into the middle of the room and placed his heavy hand over her mouth. I have borne more from you than any man ever borne from any woman. I never have loved and never can love any human creature breathing but yourself. Then he freed one arm and grasped his pistol. The certainty of immediate detection if he fired flashed across his mind, and he beat it twice upon the upturned face that almost touched his own. She staggered and fell, but raising on her knees, drew from her bosom a white handkerchief, and holding it up towards heaven, breathed one prayer for mercy to her Maker. She has frequently said to me that it would be better for everyone if she were to go away and live apart. There is a mental disorder under which she sometimes labors. It was a ghastly figure to look upon. The murderer staggering backward to the wall and shutting out the sight with his hand, seized a heavy club and struck her down. There is not on this earth a more virtuous or spotless creature than this young lady. I know her to be innocent and pure and as good as my own dear daughters. He had not moved. He had been afraid to stir. There had been a moan and motion of the hand, and with terror added to rage, he had struck and struck again. Struck and struck again. Struck and struck again. Struck and struck again.
I killed the girl, I said. So I said. I killed a girl, I said. So I said. I hit her on the head with a bloody great lump of lead. And I left her there for dead. Damn her eyes!
Charles Dickens died suddenly in his study at Gad's Hill on June the 9th, 1870. He was 58. At his funeral service in Westminster Abbey, people mourned the loss of a friend, as well as a great entertainer and creative artist, one of the acknowledged influences upon the spirit of the age. Joss Ackland was Dickens in Charles Dickens Commits Murder by Raymond Fitzsimons. The music was arranged and performed by George and Isabel Deacon, and the program was produced in Bristol by John Knight.